No, it's just the way we all acquire our native languages. It's just the way the language mechanism works, if you will, right? And it's important to make that clear, right? Hi, Roger, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Nice to meet you.
And yeah, as usual, tell us a little bit about yourself, especially when it comes to languages, your experience as a language teacher and language student yourself.
Yeah, so I was actually one of those students who didn't want to learn language when I was in school. In seventh grade, well, I took Spanish in sixth and seventh grade. Before that, it was a VHS tape on a little TV cart. But in sixth grade, I did okay, I guess. I made a B. But in seventh grade, I was really starting to wonder why I had to take Spanish, and my parents were wondering the same thing. And they basically told me that I didn't have to learn Spanish and there would be no consequences if I failed it. So that's exactly what I did. I was mostly an AB student, sometimes Cs, but in Spanish, I had an F every single quarter all the way across. And I just kind of sat there daydreaming, not really paying attention. The teacher called on me and I was like, I tried to put something together, but it was never right. And he moved on to someone else. But everything changed in high school when I began to meet native and heritage speakers who actually spoke Spanish. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever to meet people who actually speak a language because where I grew up before that, it was not diverse at all. And I moved to a new state. So finally, knowing people who spoke Spanish gave me the interest to want to learn it myself. So I actually went to my guidance counselor asking to take Spanish, and I had to wait until 10th grade. But finally, I was able to, and now I was doing really well in it. And I went to a kind of small high school that only had Spanish 1 and 2. They had Spanish 3 for one day, but then they canceled it because there weren't enough students, and there was a Spanish 1 class that was too big. But after taking Spanish 1 and 2, and I used Spanish a lot outside of class as well. So at the very beginning, all I could say were like simple things. So if one person didn't want to talk to me because I could only say a couple words, I found someone else. And if they didn't want to talk, I tried someone else. But as my level improved and I made more friends, they were more willing to talk to me. So it got to the point where, like in art class, for example, in maybe 11th grade, I was sitting with a table of students who all spoke Spanish, and I was just listening to what they said and talking to them whenever I could chime in. And I also found chat rooms online, like back in the days of AOL, MSN, and Yahoo. So I always tried to use Spanish when I could outside of class. And then in college, I majored in Spanish. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know how the world worked, but I knew that I loved Spanish. So the same thing happened at college, where my first day there, I met friends from Tokyo, Japan. So I thought that was really cool. And I took Japanese classes, and then I met friends from China, so I took Chinese classes. And then I graduated and I met some Korean friends and I took some private Korean lessons. And I'm still only at the word level in Korean, but I've always had this love for languages when I know people who speak them. So I got into teaching first adult ESL, and then later K-12 Spanish. And when I started teaching, I just had these assumptions about how languages are learned and taught based on what I knew about my own experiences. So I thought, what did I do in my classes? They gave us worksheets, we taught us grammar, we had a textbook, there was a sequence. So I started teaching like that. It was very grammar heavy, verb heavy. I loved teaching tenses because that was my favorite thing when I was a student. But of course, it didn't go very well. And a lot of people just weren't liking it, and some did. But I have this one memory of this adult ESL student who I thought was one of my best students. And toward the end of my teaching at that place, in those early years, she wanted to talk to me. And I thought, oh, maybe she's going to tell me that she loves the class because she's doing really well. And she told me that she feels like that she learned a lot, but she was now afraid to speak. Like before, she could just talk and she wasn't really conscious of what she was saying. But now she was always afraid of making mistakes, and she didn't want to, if she didn't speak, that would avoid making mistakes. So that's something that kind of started something in my head about maybe something should be done differently. But over time, as I was doing K-12 teaching and I learned about like IPAs and stuff, which was a slight step in a different direction, but you know, still largely traditional, I think, in some ways, depending on how it's done. I discovered TPRS, and then eventually Bill Van Patten, I've listened to your podcast with him before. And when I started to listen to his podcast and read his book while we're on the topic, that completely changed everything. And since then, I've been teaching communicatively, and just trying to help other teachers realize that there are all these things that are part of it that I'm guessing we might get into that should really make us question assumptions that we make about how languages are learned. And also just kind of, I try to encourage teachers to consider just abandoning grammar, like just let it go and just focus on the things that lead to acquisition and to keep in mind the process.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like a couple of things that in my mind, like the experience of that one student that you had, that's exactly what I've been thinking about lately. Like I'm starting to believe that conscious grammar instruction, not only is it not going to help you acquire the language, but it's actually going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. Exactly what happened with that student that you had.
Right.
Because, and I've felt that with a couple of the languages that I speak, that I've talked about it, the example with Italian and Portuguese, which are somewhere related to Spanish, both of them, but I started a couple of years earlier with Portuguese before I knew about comprehensible input and so on. So I did study a little bit of grammar as opposed to Italian. I studied no grammar at all, and it'll continue to be that way, of course. And I feel like I'm more fluent in Italian because I don't have that sort of conscious knowledge to rely on, which is a good thing, right? So all I can say is let's put it this way, what comes natural to me, what comes out of my mouth naturally, right? Whereas if you get that conscious grammar instruction, like it happened to your student, you start to think about everything you want to say. You start to doubt yourself, like, is this correct? Should I say this different way? I'm convinced it actually gets in the way.
I think Bill Van Patten mentioned that in his podcast that there are some studies that show that too much focus on grammar can actually impede acquisition.
Yeah.
And I remember myself having this rule in my head, and then I encounter input that doesn't match the rule. So I think, oh, the input must be wrong. Or I'm so focused on that takes away my focus from the meaning. And it's really the focus on meaning that matters.
Right. Yeah. And situations in which you're going to say something or you're going to reply to a question, like automatically or naturally, right? But at the last moment, you stop to think about it. You start like, is this right? And the funny thing is, the thing you were going to say is usually right. But you stop because, for like you said, for whatever reason, you start even doubting that input. Like, but I don't know, in irregular verbs, for example, things like that. But because it's kind of different to the rule, it looks weird to you. But you were going to say it the right way without stopping to think about it. But because of that conscious study, you did stop to think about it. And it messes up with the whole process. Yeah. So, yeah.
It might be kind of like just general test taking, where sometimes students will have this idea, like whether it's math or science or whatever, they might just have the first thing that comes to mind might be right, but then they might second guess it and then think about it too much and then they get the wrong answer.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And it is worth mentioning that, of course, early on, the implicit system won't match, it won't be native-like, but it's just how the whole process happens subconsciously. And that's one of the really big points where instruction and practice don't change things like order development or the stages of acquisition.
Right.
And when you consider those things, that it doesn't really make much sense to target grammar or to have this sequence of grammar and to just instead focus more on real communicative experiences.
Right. Yeah, because in the same way we talk to our children, you're going to communicate. When you communicate in a natural way, you're going to use the most common expressions more often and things like that. And as Stephen Krashen talks about in his, Natural Order, acquisition theory or hypothesis. For example, with English, like, because in most classes, we tend to learn, like in traditional classes, we tend to learn the language based on how consciously difficult the rules are, right? Like, for example, in English, adding an S at the end of third person, that's pretty straightforward from a conscious standpoint, right? But in his hypothesis, it actually proves that that's one of the latest structures to develop, right?
Exactly.
So you try to target it artificially, right? Earlier on, again, you're going to mess up the whole process.
Right. Yeah, because as you said, traditionally that is one of the very first things that's taught. And when I taught ESL, more traditionally, that's what I did as well. But I'm guessing you might be familiar with the same sequence where at the beginning it's just the base form of the verb, and then they begin to use ing for everything. And over time, that becomes more native like, but at the very end, that's when the S happens. And all that instruction, practice, and error correction along the way didn't change that. It's still going to happen at the end.
Exactly. Yeah, and as I always say, this is not a knock on teachers, because I know for the most part that's all we know. Like, that was our experience as language students, sorry. And when if you started to become a teacher in college, that's what you got. And that's back to your point with Spanish, because you had grammar instruction, but you were also listening to your colleagues at the same time. We tend to give the credit to the grammar instruction because that's all you need. I mean, that's all we know, right? But in your case, what actually helped you acquire the language was listening to your colleagues speak Spanish. What you were just listening to them, right? That anecdote that you mentioned. And because the so, sorry, yeah, last thing, like, because the traditional study, the conscious study of it, is more measurable or tangible, right? It's easier to give it the credit what it had was actually helping you.
We generally know what's conscious, and what we remember is being taught things and then memorizing those and practicing them, and then eventually getting better at those with traditional tests and things. But we often aren't aware of what's subconscious, so all the stuff going on behind the scenes. And I think people tend not to be aware as well of the implicit system as even existing in the first place, let alone being a much bigger thing than conscious knowledge, with conscious knowledge having all the limitations. But yes, I do want to also agree with that teachers are doing what they think is best, and I think it should be commendable that teachers are teaching language regardless of methods. And there are things where, like, if a teacher is, no matter how they teach, if they're making students love the language and want to learn more and want to, learn more about the culture, I think that's commendable regardless of their approach. And I know when I was teaching traditionally, I was also doing what I thought was best at the time. And I had to learn about this stuff to really rethink how I do things. So I think it's great that you do what you do, and that people are trying to raise awareness so that more teachers become aware of how their brain acquires language, so that we can align what we do with that, and also have realistic expectations of students as well.
That's the power of the internet, right? That we didn't have before. And I also a huge point that you made about, I mean, in your story, that you didn't like it at the beginning, but then because you associated it with being able to communicate with other people, to being able to learn more about their culture and so on, it's such a huge part of it for me. Because I don't learn languages for the usual practical reasons, meaning to get a job, things like that. Obviously, I tend to want to learn languages that are gonna allow me to communicate with more people, right? So I'd rather, all things equal, I'd rather learn Russian than Albanian, for example, right?
Yeah, me
Because
too.
it's gonna allow me to communicate with more people. But I've just seen it, like, whenever I start learning a language, my interest for the culture, for the country, for their traditions, it just grows and grows and grows. And I don't know, I think languages are just such a huge part, or to me, they're just such a huge part when it comes to having better relationships with other cultures, with other countries. You know, I don't know if it sounds too idealistic, but that's the way I look at it, you know. And it certainly made all the difference for you, right?
Yeah, I think it's incredible how much that languages can really connect people to other cultures and to other groups of people, other places. Because, I mean, sure, you can just have everything translated, but to actually talk to someone in either a different language or a shared language, or to learn things through the language, I think is pretty neat.
Yeah, because that's our ultimate goal, right? To be able to communicate with other people. Yeah,
exactly.
And I'm curious about your experience. So the first experience you had with Spanish that you didn't like it at all, I'm assuming that was traditional instruction, right?
Like, right. And admittedly, the high school classes were too, but with the middle school classes, yeah, it was extremely traditional, but I also didn't know anyone who spoke it other than the teacher, because I went to a very, it was pretty much a 99-something percent white school, and I don't know anyone in the community who spoke a language besides English, except for a neighbor whose wife spoke Tagalog, but other than that, I didn't know anyone. So for me, it was this strange concept, like why learn another language? What's it used for? Where am I ever going to use this?
Right.
In high school, my Spanish 1 teacher taught very traditionally as well, but there I knew people who spoke Spanish, so my desire to learn it was ultimately much higher than power. I wouldn't have known different teaching styles anyway.
Right.
But I think what kept me going was my desire to use it outside of class and those real communicative experiences.
Yeah, so it had nothing to do with the actual method your teachers were using. It's just that you found out the reason to like them, to learn them, right? Yeah.
Right.
And then, like those first years, so you started to like it, but there were still traditional classes. But were you listening to those kids right away speak Spanish all the time, or?
I think it was more about me trying to talk to Spanish speaking friends. And I think they kind of intrinsically adjusted their language to my level, because they knew that if they talked as if they talked to a peer, that I wouldn't have understood really anything. So they really kind of lowered their language to my level, just like parents do when they talk to toddlers, so that I could kind of participate and understand what they're saying. And of course, as my level grew, then I could say more and more, but especially at the very beginning, I couldn't really say too much. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the way it works. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then we got to the point that we were mentioning before, that because you were having classes, but listening to your friends at the same time, you probably gave classes the credit because you didn't know otherwise, right? I mean, you and everybody around you, but it was the second thing that was actually helping you, right? The thing is, you couldn't measure it, yeah.
Right. And even in traditional classes, there are usually some communicative moments here and there, whether it's giving directions, things like that.
Yeah.
And I would say that in my Spanish 2 class, there was a different teacher, and I felt like we had a genuinely positive relationship, and she was asking me, like, hey, how was my weekend? How are things? When I was sick, she wrote in Spanish to help me feel better. And all of those moments to me felt truly communicative, and maybe they were from her end as well.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know in hindsight if she had some kind of goal, like trying to insert grammar and things like that, but I viewed it as communicative. So to me, it was genuine communication.
Right. Yeah, again, you're right. It's not that it's 100% useless, you know, we're exaggerating here, but it's just, yeah, like you said, the teacher's gonna ask you questions about your life or how you're doing, and you're gonna listen to stories within the context of the textbook. You're gonna hear stories, right? You're gonna read stories, so you're gonna get things here and there. It's just that the conscious part that messes up the whole thing, in my opinion, of course. But yeah, of course, you're gonna get
if I had been taught like fully communicatively from the very beginning, I can only imagine where I would have gone instead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you would have those moments in which you have to stop to think about what you want to say. You're even like double guessing, like you said, that you're going to say something because that's the way you acquired it. But at the last moment, or right after you said it, you start doubting yourself because of that monitor, that conscious knowledge, right? Yeah.
One interesting observation is that I'm in the like how do you say group for Spanish teachers, where they ask each other like how do you say things, questions, and some of the most common things that people ask about are the things that are heavily taught in grammar classes, like the personal I and ser and estar, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That despite all of these, like it's semester after semester of teaching and practicing these traditionally, these are some of the things that non-native teachers have the most trouble with, even as teachers. And if we didn't get it in multiple semesters or even a college major or minor, how can we expect students to get it in one or two semesters or in a unit?
Yeah, plus the fact that you're listening to it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to remember it. You just need repetitions, right? It's like exactly what you said. I'll always remember the first time I came to Poland.
Mm.
Like I used to ask my Polish friends, because again, that's what we all know. Like if you want to learn the language, you ask them, how do you say this or that? And I perfectly vividly remember asking them about, I don't know what it was, but they told me what it meant or how you say it in Polish. And 5 minutes later, I'd forgotten. 5 minutes later, I'm not talking about a month or no, 5 minutes later. And the funny thing is it happened to everyone. And I continue to see that all the time. Like I like going to language events and reunions to speak other languages. And people are constantly asking out of curiosity many times, which is good, but how do you say whatever in this language? And 5 minutes later, again, how do you say that? Because I totally forgot. It just, because then you're relying on your conscious memory, but fortunately it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, I can figure something 20 seconds later.
Exactly, yeah. Even if you perfectly understand what it means, or even if it's within the right or within the context of a story, the fact that you understand what it means doesn't mean that you're going to be able to produce it right away.
Yeah, right? It takes lots of exposure and the input, ideally during real communication with a focus on meaning with a low effective filter, etc., for this to really become what's called robustly represented.
Yeah. And yeah, and I think it's important because I see a lot of people beat themselves up because of it. Because, right, because they think once they understand what it means, once they were taught how you say a specific word or object or whatever, I don't know if consciously or subconsciously, they believe they should be able to produce it. And when 5 minutes later, they forget, they start to beat themselves up. Oh, what a memory I have, and things of that nature. When it's not your fault. It happens to everyone. It's the way it works, you know?
And that might be influenced by a lot of traditional expectations of memorizing things and not making mistakes. So students are pushed heavily in those classes, like I was in high school. Like, you're supposed to know this. Yeah. I even had this one class in college where the professor, she showed us a ton of these new words all at once, one after the other, in an unknown, like a different writing system. And then right after that, she quizzed us on it. And if we didn't know something, I was like, well, I just showed you this. Why don't you know it? So that might be the most extreme example I've had. But
yeah,
I think that like in my own classes, if students don't know something, I just give it to them. Like there's no pressure to remember things about language in my classes. I just, if they don't know something, I just tell them.
Yeah, exactly. It is that example is might be an exaggeration, but it perfectly shows what we mean here. Yeah. But and it may sound simplistic, but I think it's true. It's just if you don't know it, you don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is, because it sounds too obvious, is there's no shortcut, right? Like. Right. Either you already know it or you don't. And if you don't, it's nobody's fault. You just need more exposure or more repetition or to listen to more stories, right? And I'm talking about specific words or sentences or communication in general. If you can yet, you can. You know, there's no way to hack the process. There's no shortcut. That's the main thing.
Yeah, we're not like computers where you just type something in and it's there. It takes time for it to gradually increase to the point where it can be more easily accessed and represented with all these different connections to different things in our brain.
Right. And then when moving on to the other languages that you mentioned, like Japanese, Chinese, and Korean, again, your interested was came from trying to communicate with other people and so on. But did you start with traditional classes again, or did you listen to your friend to your to those friends like you did with Spanish, or how was it?
Initially, those were kind of a repeat of Spanish where they were taught traditionally with a textbook and taught grammar and, memorization and error avoidance. But I used them outside of class with my peers. So, like my college classmates mostly, both with Chinese and Japanese. But recently, far later than that, I started taking this online CI Chinese class, and that is taught with very comprehensible approaches. So that's been my first experience as a student learning a new language. And before that, everything was more traditional, taught traditionally in class, but I try to use it when I could outside of class during real communication.
Right, because I'm guessing, I mean, that certainly was the case for me. Like when you're in your case, when you start with Spanish, even if it's like traditional grammar and so on, there are a lot of words that are similar. So you can pick up things here and there, right? But when we're talking about Japanese, for example, I don't know how it was for you, but for me, that happened with Polish. That I always talk about the fact that with related languages, you can sort of fool yourself for a while, right? But when you encounter a completely different language, in your case, a different alphabet and so on, that was the eye-opening experience for me, actually. But for you, it must have been like harder than Spanish, right? Or
Maybe. In terms of the writing system, yes. In terms of reading, I will admit that consciously, I feel like I've always been able to like use things in grammar quickly, like teach me a rule and I can use it right away. But I think because that's how it was taught, it kind of like consciously I was able to just do all that stuff. But the acquisition, of course, is a separate process from conscious learning and conscious knowledge. So acquisition happens the way it does, regardless of environment and regardless of language and so on. So the things that were taught may have benefited conscious knowledge, which is very limited, but the real conversations that I had and the real communicative moments, those are what really benefited my acquisition.
Right. So I'm guessing because you sort of enjoy that conscious process. I mean, it's not helping you with acquisition, but you sort of enjoy it. Then it may have helped you when it comes to having a better comprehension, when you try to communicate with your friends, which was the thing that actually trumped acquisition. Right? I guess.
Yeah, I think it's just about the two different systems, like the explicit system, which is all about conscious knowledge, but it's very limited, versus the implicit system, which forms the bulk of language use, especially at later stages, which grows exclusively by comprehending input. And the explicit system kind of arguably isn't needed. I just happen like the thing about people who become language teachers is that there tends to be this small group of people who loves grammar, maybe about 5% of the total population, based on a study I think from Canada. But what a lot of language teachers don't realize is that the vast majority of the general public doesn't have that same interest in grammar. Like 95% of people, give or take, just don't like for us, oh, this is how direct object pronouns work, and we might be interested, but the average person might be like, okay, so what? That's another thing as well, that I think a lot of like the people who love grammar might be more likely to want to study language consciously or become language teachers. But I think we should be aware that the average person just doesn't have that same interest in grammar.
And those who do, it doesn't mean that it's going to help them acquire the language, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, and yes, exactly as you said. Ironically, even in those who love grammar, we still acquire language subconsciously by comprehending input, not because of the grammar, but despite it.
Cool. And yeah, and going forward to your teaching experience, you mentioned the case of that student, but do you have any other example of someone you had when you started teaching the traditional way that was still with you after you decided to switch, and the difference it made in those students?
Unfortunately, because of switches in schools and things like that, not really. Because when I first started teaching that very first year, that was middle and high school, and that year went horribly. So I subbed for a year and then started teaching elementary, and that was so much better. And I was at one school for 5 years, and that school, there was a shift from teaching traditionally when I got there toward teaching with what are often called CI approaches like TPRS toward the end. But I still didn't fully know what I was doing, and I still didn't know about like I had this view that I think a lot of teachers have of CI being a method where they use CI quote unquote to teach grammar and the same old thing. And I was kind of doing that in the beginning as I was just starting to become aware of this stuff. But it wasn't until the second school, maybe about halfway through, that I began to learn about Bill Van Patten and communicative language teaching. And toward the end, I started doing some of that stuff. And I did see, I would say, continued benefits to students where, so at that school, I had this afternoon duty where I just open car doors for students and they go to their spot, right? But there's often time between when they get there and when their car arrives. So that gives me a little bit of time to talk to students. And I often did in Spanish while they're waiting for their vehicle. And I had this spontaneous conversations with students. Like I would see that they have like a Pokemon shirt or a baseball hat or something. And I would ask questions like, oh, te gusta el baseball? Or maybe they're holding a book, te gusta leer? And they would say, sí. I don't know, has leído Harry Potter? Or has jugado Mario Kart? And just simple conversations like that. And even if they were answering in a simple yes or no, they were still mostly able to follow what I was saying. So I couldn't have said that same thing when I taught traditionally. And now I'm at a new school for the first time this year. And I've started this year teaching highly communicatively. And it's only been a couple months in, but I'm very impressed with what they've been able to do so far. So I would say, although I don't know students that I saw at the very beginning because of the school changes, I've seen differences in interest that students have in class and their ability to just follow along and participate and just have a relaxed atmosphere where it's not about like you should have known that or why didn't you memorize that?
So even if you didn't have one student in both periods, you can, I was about to say that you can see the difference in their interest, in their engagement in class, in their how relaxed they are, right?
Yeah, and sometimes they'll just ask me spontaneous things. Like next week, we'll be doing something that I did at my previous school where the same thing happened, where we just start talking about what books, movies, video games, and shows we like. And they'll start asking me things like, has jugado, I don't know, Roblox or te gusta. No, I'll have these things on the board as things to say or to see just for meanings, but that's not me telling them to say something. They choose to say something, which shows me that they're really engaged in it. They're into it. They, yeah.
So they're acquiring the language the right way. They're talking about things they're super interested in, and they feel relaxed in class. They feel like they want to talk to you. Yeah, it's just gonna happen naturally. That's what I'm always talking about. And it's so important what you said about CI not being like comprehensible input not being a method, because sometimes when I'm talking about it with just random people, or you know, because I'm so passionate about it that I talk to other people about that, and yeah, I try to communicate it in a way that they don't think it's just the newest technique or you know something we've just come up with. No, it's just the way we all acquire our native languages. It's just the way the language mechanism works, if you will, right? And it's, yeah, it's important to make that clear, right?
Yeah, I think that like that's the same misconception that I had when I first started learning about this stuff. I just viewed it as a new way to teach the better attendance or whatever it may be. But going back to order development, because as Bill Van Patten has said, when we When we comprehend input, what goes on is that our brain subconsciously processes pieces of data of the input, and the things that are processed might not be what teachers think or want are being processed. Mm. So even when teachers try to target things using CI, that might not be what their brain is processing, that they might not be at that stage yet, and or that ordered development area.
Right.
Are they ready to do that?
Right. Yeah, like you don't really know what's going on in here when because right, that makes sense. I hadn't thought about that, because that means there's no point in targeting any structure, because you don't really know if that's actually helping them. Like, for some artificial reason, I mean, sometimes it might make sense. Like, you know, you think it's the those are the most common expressions or verbs, so you try to target them, but it might actually not help them because they're not going to be able to process that early on.
And I forget if it's Bill or Krashen who said that more common things are naturally going to be more common anyway, and they'll just show up more often. Exactly. So I did do that as well when I started. I started, looking up the list of the most common words, and I started to focus on those. But instead, what I do is I focus on whatever the meaning is, whatever the content is. So let's say we're talking about video game genres or the solar system or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. It's good to limit new words at a time so that it's not too much new stuff at once, mm-hmm. that it becomes annoying. But I focus on the most useful things to say on the topic, where it is good to expose them to words and input that they'll encounter later on, like in tasks and things. But I mean, things that are naturally more common, like, you know, the or of and so on, they'll mm-hmm. naturally appear more often.
Yeah, exactly. Or the most common birds, like ser, star, exactly. Cool. And are you learning any new language, or have you started learning a language after you decided to switch to comprehensible input? So, like, completely comprehensible input based?
Unfortunately, I think it's hard to find, especially classes that are like that. Like, the Chinese class I'm doing is the first real thing like that I've found that I could do in a class setting. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are things to be done outside of class settings, but and that class is great and I love it, but I've already had Chinese traditional classes before that, so it's not from scratch. Mm-hmm. I do want to learn like Arabic, Russian, maybe Vietnamese, but I haven't started those where like there isn't like a version of the Chinese class I'm taking for those languages that I'm aware of. So I would love to try that. Like, if there are teachers who teach those languages very communicatively, that would be a great experience.
Yeah.
But I hope this becomes more common so that things like that aren't so rare.
Yeah, because, besides that actually helping you acquire the language, it's also a great exercise for us teachers to sort of realize what the student needs or how you're feeling when the other person is communicating, whether gestures are really helping you understand what's going on, or pictures, or what it is that is really helping you understand the meaning and things like that.
Right. I think knowing native speakers who are willing to adjust their level to a learner's level, that could be a great resource, like a great way to have real communication instead of just learning about a language or like communicative classes and things like that. But unfortunately, absolute beginners or just novices are extremely dependent on what are called sympathetic interlocutors, people who are willing to make themselves understandable. And the higher a person's level gets, the more they can understand on their own, but it is pretty difficult at the very beginning level. So one thing I'm still trying to figure out is if there's an ideal way for people to kind of approach languages on their own independently.
Right.
At that level, so because that's pretty hard to do. I haven't found the answer to that yet, but that's something that I'd like to think more about.
Right, yeah, because especially the language is different from your own native language or the languages that you already speak, even the easiest of resources like cartoons, for example, are not going to be comprehensible. Yeah. I mean, in that case, for example, with Russian, I do know a couple of projects on YouTube that they create resources even for complete beginners. You know, they just talk about cultural things about Russia or obviously, depending on the level, you can get a little bit deeper or not, right? But the one I use when I started learning Russian, which I'm still on that journey, of course, is Comprehensible Russian. That I had her on the channel on the podcast, and I don't know if she has private classes as well. I don't remember, but what I mean is that there's new projects, you know, more and more by the minute, which is awesome, in which, you know, they just tell stories or talk about their countries, their culture, in a comprehensible way, even for complete beginners.
That's good. I do remember finding a comprehensible French series. So I'm guessing it might be sort of similar to that, where they it's like I'm trying to remember what he did. It was like, I think he drew on a paper and he says like, "Hi, I'm his name," and then he just has some very tangible things, but using French almost the entire time. Yeah. And I'm guessing it might be similar with the Russian content.
Yeah. And there's more and more languages there out there. And for example, recently I started with, because I had another friend I had on the podcast. Like, she's half American, half Norwegian. And she decided to start a project with Norwegian. And she's got a playlist for complete beginners. And out of curiosity, I started last week. And I might stick to it, because she's got a lot of content and it's awesome. Because the video she's creating for complete beginners is just a bunch of pictures. And she talks about, what is this? A cat. And the cat has, you know, a scarf or a hat, and what color is it? Like, super simple stuff at the beginning. I'm still in complete beginner's territory, so I'll keep everyone updated when, you know, as soon as I keep getting better. But like, super simple things, but comprehensible, which is the key to the entire process. And that might get you to a point in which you can start using the real world to keep getting better, right? Like, cartoons or comic books or even conversations with people who make the conscious effort to adapt to your comprehension ability, so you understand what they're talking about, right? Like, that first period is the toughest one, because you can't really understand anything, right?
Exactly.
But you need someone to make that effort to help you out, right?
And I think it's great that more of this stuff is being done, and I hope it continues, because a lot of people leave traditional classes feeling like languages just aren't for them, like, I'm not a language person, or I don't know this language. And after multiple semesters, like, the most common response I get when people find out that I'm a Spanish teacher is, they're like, oh, I took Spanish in high school. So I might say, oh, ¿qué te gusta hacer? Something like, just to talk to them in Spanish. And they say, oh, no, I don't actually speak it. I can maybe say, ¿dónde está el baño? And that's it.
Right.
So yeah, I think it's great that more of this stuff is being done, and that more teachers are becoming aware of acquisition versus learning about language.
Yeah.
And the distinction of having real communication with a focus on meaning versus using CI as a method. So yeah, I'm just hoping that things continue in this direction and more teachers become aware of it.
Yeah, that's so common. Like, all the American students that I have, or people that I've met from, especially from America, mm-hmm. I took Spanish in high school, but I can communicate or anything, yeah. Right? Yeah, it's so common and so important what you said as well. Like, I keep talking about it and I'll never get tired of it, but, you know, for everyone, you see that I'm not the only one talking about it, that because of the traditional grammar approach, a lot of people end up thinking that languages are not for them, like you said, or they're not talented for languages. It just breaks my heart, because I felt that way myself, to be honest. And because I've been on both sides, I know what I'm talking about. I know what it feels like to think that it's never going to happen, like, you're never going to be able to learn the language. That happened to me with English. I've talked about it many times. To actually enjoying every single minute of it, which is what I do right now. And, you know, I consume content in several different languages at the same time. I enjoy every single minute of it. The process working, because it's, if you follow the right principle, it's going to work for everyone.
That's great, yeah.
And yeah, it just, that's the main message, like, I want to convey, like, a lot of things, but like, we can all get it done, you know, and while enjoying the process. That I'll never get tired of repeating that.
Because
that,
right. And yeah, there's no such thing as not being a language person, because
exactly
the same mechanisms and processes are involved, whether it's a first language or a second language. So anyone who's acquired any language can acquire any other language. I mean, the only exception I can think of is maybe severe brain damage or something, but
right, overall, right.
Yeah. But as if people have acquired any language, if they have a first language, then the same processes will lead to any other language. So that speaking any language or knowing any language means that they are capable of learning language in general. And I kind of tell that to my students too, like it's never too late or too early to learn a language. And if you've learned English, which most of them, that's their first language, then they are language people. Like every single person can acquire a new language. It's just a matter of the conditions being met for acquisition to comprehend the language and ideally focus on meaning and so on.
Yeah, exactly. Like, doesn't matter how old you are or how young or where you're from. Yeah. It's just that we've been going about it the wrong way. It's that simple, right? And again, I'm empathetic to teachers when I talk about this. Like, this is not about teachers. This is just about the method. Because like I said, that's the method we all grew up with. So for the most part, we don't know an alternative.
Yeah, I think teacher training programs need to really learn more about acquisition or focus more on it, because sometimes some of this stuff is relegated to like a paragraph in a textbook, and then that's about it. Oh, there's this guy named Crashton, and he came up with I+1, and then let's move on to other stuff. But I think it should really be made front and center. Like, okay, this is what acquisition is. Here's how it works. Here's how to set up conditions for it. And I also like Bill's idea of not treating language as subject matter. Like, it's not something where you're taught it and then you're assessed on it and you get an A because you memorize these conjugations, but it's just something different from subject matter.
Right. Yeah, like if you want to learn Portuguese, you don't learn Portuguese, you learn about other topics in Portuguese, right? That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. And then you have toddlers and kids who have never been to a school setting before with this impressive language system already in their heads. And it's abstract, complex, again, from Bill's work. And it makes you wonder, okay, for people who haven't seen these linguistic trees, you have things like verb phrases, noun phrases, tense phrases, and so on, which look nothing like textbook rules and charts. And then the question becomes, okay, how did that get in their heads? How does this toddler have this complex tree in their heads? Surely their parents didn't teach them either traditional grammar or that stuff consciously.
Yeah.
And of course, it got there by just understanding English all subconsciously, forming this implicit system in their heads.
Exactly. Yeah, like, don't tell me how it works, but it does. Like, don't tell me what actually goes on in there. But yeah, the funny thing is we always trust the process when it comes to toddlers. Well, we don't with adults. You know, like, nobody in their right mind would think about teaching their 6-month-old son, you know, the present perfect or whatever, you know, they just try to communicate.
Right.
Anyway. Cool. So, any other thing that you have in mind? Something we forgot to talk about, or any other experience that you can recall that you think might be interesting? Or
I would just remind teachers to always try to focus on meaning, and by that I mean the actual content that's being done. Where I find that a lot of people, they have something in mind that they want to teach, again, usually grammar related or vocab list, and they try to find this perfect resource that has that in it,
right?
But it's not really about that content, it's really about the grammar. And I would encourage teachers to try to reverse that and do the opposite. Instead, imagine focusing on a story, and regardless of whatever structures and stuff it has, or an interesting topic that's of high interest to students, and to make it comprehensible at their level, of course, make it level appropriate. But to, like, if you ask students what they did over the weekend, and you talk about that, make it actually about what people did over the weekend and what does it say about us and how, what can we learn about each other as people. Make that the actual content instead of it being about the grammar.
Yeah.
Because again, it goes back to what Crash has been arguing since the late 70s, I think, or the early 80s, that we acquire language in one and only one way, by comprehending input. And CI, since it's not a method, this is not saying, of course, that TPRS is the only way. Like, I only use that occasionally myself, but rather it's a process. It, like, input is language that is understood during real communication, and that's part of the definition of what input is. Yeah. So comprehensible input, by definition, includes a communicative element to it. And I recommend looking into Sandra Savignon's definition of communication as the expression, interpretation, sometimes negotiation of meaning for a purpose in a context, and what those purposes are, which Bill lays out while we're on the topic, such as having like either a practical purpose or building social relationships or for entertainment. But as long as you have these purposes going on, and the focus is on meaning itself, then that's what leads to acquisition.
Yeah.
And I guess lastly, I would also highly recommend, I've been reading this now, I'm not done yet, but I'm really loving Florencia Henshaw's new book, Common Ground, also with Maris Hawkins. Okay. And this book is full of different ways of doing things in class that are highly communicative. And I'm just impressed by the quality and quantity of things that that can be done with a single topic. And just, there are all these like pre-reading, during reading, post-reading things, and different ways to have students interact while focused on meaning rather than grammar being the goal.
Cool, right. So you said Common Ground is the name, right?
Yeah, that's the main title. As a subtitle of SLA Research Goes to the Classroom or something to that effect. But Common Ground is the main part of the title.
Perfect. Yeah, absolutely. Like, and you know, you can talk about one topic in so many different ways that you're actually going to talk about things they're interested in. And again, they're going to be listening to the target language in different ways, in a natural way, of course. So yeah, like, talk to them about video games. Don't talk to them about quantum physics. I'm just exaggerating because it contains the structures you want to target, right? Yeah.
I like that picture of the baby where the father has the book that says quantum entanglement for babies, and the baby's like, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know some teachers might only be aware of TPRS and they might say, well, that's just not for me, so I'm going to teach traditionally. But TPRS is not the only way
to
teach with comprehensible input as the main main part of it.
Yeah, that's important as well. Like, it's just a way, like TPRS is a way to provide input, but comprehensible input is the key to the entire process, right? So it's all about understanding what you're talking about, right? So but you can, just like you said, you can be talking to your students about what they did for the weekend or the games they played and so on, and that's comprehensible input, right? You don't need to tell stories all the time and use props and act crazy, and you know, it's just a way to provide input. So
it is nothing against that, but for teachers who might not want to do that, there are other options.
Yeah. Personally, I teach adults, and we create stories and so on, but we don't have those antics, if you want, that you can see in some classroom examples, right? We just create stories, but we're talking all the time. I mean, I'm talking most of the time, of course, but it's more of a conversation between adults, right?
Right.
So, come on. Okay. So yeah, thank you so much, Roger. That was a pleasure. That was good.
Welcome. Thank you as well.
And yeah. So do you have any website or channel or resources that you put some content on, or?
I actually don't really have anything of my own. Like, I don't have a website, or I don't sell anything. I do share this document that you're definitely welcome to share it if you want to, or I just share a bunch of units and stuff that I've made for teachers to use as they wish. But okay. Yeah, I don't have a website or anything.
Cool. Yeah, some resource for teachers or whatever, something you have that you that you use yourself or you document your journey, whatever, in case it can be useful for other teachers or students. Perfect.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll send that to you.
Great. Okay. So, yeah, thank you again. And yeah, I'll have a good day, Roger. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Take care.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much for watching this interview. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope it was helpful for you. And if you want to know more about language learning, language acquisition, like, you know, what's the best way to learn a language, ideas for language learning, the best resources at different levels, here you can find the whole playlist with all the interviews I've done so far with different researchers, teachers, polyglots, and so on. And finally, right here, you smash this guy right in the face to subscribe to my channel. I really appreciate it. And I'll see you in the next one. Bye-bye.